Welcome to another episode of the Open Science Radio. This time we have episode 122. It's April 25th, 2018. And we would like to have a small wrap-up session of the Open Science Conference. As usually, Matthias is with me. Hi, Matthias.
Good morning.
And clearly our special guest for this, who could do this better than Guido Scherb?
Yes, thank you. Hello from Kiel.
Hi, Guido. Guido, just in case somebody starts with this episode regarding the Open Science Conference, maybe you give a small introduction who you are and why we talk actually to you today.
Yeah, so I'm Guido Scherb. As I mentioned before, I work for ZBW, Leibniz Information Center for Economics. It's located in Kiel in Hamburg, and there I'm coordinating the so-called Leibniz Research Alliance Science 2.0. And in this context, I am involved in both organizing the Barcamp and the Open Science Conference. And yeah, they took place in March, and today is a good opportunity to just reflect a bit what happened at the Barcamp and what happened at the Open Science Conference.
Exactly. So this is our job for today. So we would like to have first a quick glance at the Barcamp and then at the conference. Maybe we can start a little bit with some hard facts about the Barcamp. So how many people were there and how this was organized?
Yeah, so the Barcamp, so it was the fourth Barcamp. We started in Hamburg, moved to Cologne, and since last year and this year we are in Berlin. And in Berlin we organized it together with Wikimedia, so it was organized together and also took place at Wikimedia for the second year. And we had around 80 participants like last year, and in our experience, it was again a really good event. It was fully booked after 4 weeks. And so we found some sort of good running system to run a Barcamp or a Barcamp Open Science. And we think now we found a good running system for our Barcamp. And like last year, we had a good mixture of different disciplines, also a good mixture of women and men, and also a good mixture between some open science pioneers and newbies. And so that this made the Barcamp somehow special, and it is well adopted by the community. And we also think that with 80 participants, we are really have enough people there, because it's somehow has some familiar character with such amount of participants.
Mm-hmm. You cannot scale it up indefinitely, right? Then you will not have these small groups that can discuss, but you would have to arrange it differently. Yeah? And also, what you mentioned, attendance of newbies. This was for me always a surprise, right? That we have roughly half of the people are new, which is really good in my opinion, right? That we are not sitting all in the same pot and talking over and over about the same things, but that new people entered and bring new ideas and carry old ideas out of that. And that we basically have the mission of the Barcamp is fulfilled if we can spread these ideas between different groups, between different communities. And I guess this is really the case considering this kind of setup. Yeah, topic-wise, what did we discuss there? What did we do?
Yeah, so we had 20 sessions about different topics. And so first of all, maybe referring to your point is that it's good that we have many new faces every year, and this also give us a reason why this format is so important. But it's also clear that it needs some time that open science really can come into practice. So it's also clear that some topics are repeatedly discussed every year. But I think it's normal because we have a lot of new people there every year, and some of them starting at the beginning. So I think Barcamp is a good format for this exchange. So in this year, I would characterize the sessions in three ranges of topics. The first topic group would be we had many sessions about open science in general, so or its future or the future of open science and how to bring it closer to researchers. So what are the motivations behind doing open science or not doing open science? What are can be valid reasons for opt out? What is missing? What incentives should be created and so on? And then we had some sort of practical sessions, which focus on concrete tools or generally on tools. So there are many tools out there. Which tools are best for me? Some people presented some projects or they talked about license in open science, so more practical oriented. And this year was interesting in contrast to last year's Barcamp. We had some sessions about the role of research software in science. I think research software is getting more and more important in science, also along to scientific publication and scientific data. Research software is important because it processes data and reproduces output data that is relevant for scientific finding. And we had some sessions about publishing and citing. And one interesting observation is also that we had a major topic on research data and FAIR data this year also at the conference, and we had no dedicated session for that at the Barcamp. So currently this year, the participants were not so much interested in research data. But I think you interviewed most of the session moderators, and maybe you can give some more insight to some sessions or what the moderator reported to you in your podcast.
Yeah, clearly. I mean, I completely agree that software was rather not dominating, but was rather present there. So this is definitely one thing that was also very interesting, especially for me, who was also pushing in this direction. So there were a lot of things starting from the citation itself, and but also how the stuff can be found. And I guess this is good to see. I mean, you said there is not much about data discussed, or the FAIR data was not such a big topic, because I think this is a rather, let's say, early adapter community. And this means for us, the data issue is already solved in a way. Yeah? And you see also that there are now structures provided by different, institutions, while the software topic is still not yet properly settled and still has to, be put in the head of people, right? And we also, we can refer to this. There's also now this handout that we generated for this in order to make people aware of the issues that come with the scientific research of and this was also partially discussed there. There was a very interesting discussion, as I said, with Sophia Dörner regarding the citation themselves, but also things like findability of software. And it's, as said, it's not clear how to deal with this. And there's still a lot of hurdles. And this is why there is a lot of discussion required before we can really, make recommendations that then can be adopted on a higher level.
And there were also a number of really meta topic related sessions. For example, something like talking to scientists. How do you actually talk to scientists about their work, about these open science aspects? What are reasons for opting out? Is there some legitimate reason for opting out? Is there some legal reason that you need to opt out? And what is the community view about this, and how to encounter these reasons? How to maybe lower the barrier that's in front of people that might seem like a reason to opt out from open science? Another session I have in mind is something that we also had over the last couple of years, looking at what is the good things of doing science openly, and what is the bad things, and what are limits of transparency, which is kind of in the same root of what are reasons for opting out. So this has specifically been a topic that has repeatedly turned up in discussions. I would interpret it in a way that people are actually more involved with thinking about whether they should do it or whether they shouldn't or whether they can't. And that's why this has been such an ongoing discussion and has been even increased this year, I think.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely agree. And also we had a really, yeah, many sessions about just reflecting on open science. And yeah, in one session I have in mind, it was the topic, what makes fun with open science. So it's not only a burden. It can also make some fun to do apply open science. As, for example, if you work with citizens together. And yes, and you said there also many topics were about reasons for opt out or why you are not doing open science. What are the barriers? And so my observation is that so somehow you can, this reason, you can separate them between individual and structural reason. Individual is because no time, it have no benefit or is no incentive for me. And structural reasons is no support, I have no support, missing policy, missing infrastructure, and so on. And so my experience is that at the barcamp, the individual reasons can be addressed best. So sometimes an individual reason is I don't have the knowledge about to do open science. And this is a good point. You can go to the barcamp and ask other people or propose a session or attend sessions to learn more about this practical things to gain some knowledge about open science. So that is so my observations for this year, but also for last year's, I think.
I'm not sure, to be honest, because in principle, we need these kind of barcamps, especially to discuss also the structural things. You completely agree that these two facets are there, and the we have there the chance actually to discuss the structural part in order to, well, get the opinions about this and then forward this to, let's say, higher levels, right? And then this can be then, well, put into strategies or laws, whatever. But it's, I think, something really essential that we address this there as well. And in a way, this was done, right? I mean, for example, things like libraries as publishers. Huh? So this is a very structural thing that we should definitely address, and that is something that we luckily see more and more, that there's more interest going away from the commercial publishers and seeing, well, basically all traditional partners, basically the libraries, as infrastructure that can be used for disseminating knowledge or research results. Maybe another topic which goes also in this direction, the peer-to-peer networks or a blockchain and these kind of distributed solutions for this, which is, I guess we get a little bit into this as well, which was also discussed. This structural thing, well, coming more from the community, but also there, this has to be embraced by institutions and accepted by them. So I think it's definitely, and this is the cool thing about it, you can gain something directly personal that you can directly do yourself. You can change how you do. But on the other hand, you can also take out these topics, bring them to higher levels, and hopefully facilitate a change on that level as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Maybe I would say it, individual reasons are discussed more on a practical level because it affects their daily life, and structural reasons maybe also more on a higher level. So what is needed, what is missing, and so on. And so this can maybe lead us to, you already mentioned it, to the Ignition talk by Lambert, and he also gave a session about decentralize more the publishing system. So his major claim was that we have to remove our dependency from a single trusted platform, in which, so to a more decentralized platform in which all scientists can contribute. So, I think, maybe you can report more on this Ignition talk by Lambert. You also interviewed him, I think.
Yeah, so in principle, The main idea is, as you mentioned, that we have these trusted platforms, namely publishers and so on, where we can carry our wishes to, and basically then basically distribution of knowledge can happen. And the question is if we really need this, because they are, well, are not ideal in this perspective, that they are expensive, that they are sometimes silos and so on. And the idea is that you use peer-to-peer networks. So, you know, blockchain is rather big right now in general as a concept. Questions if this can be applied to science. And there are many groups behind this or that are trying to push this. For example, there's even this blockchain for science, kind of a think tank that was started by Sünke Bartling. I'm also part of this, little disclaimer. But Lambert is pushing this also in his field or in his institution. And I think there can be a lot of stuff really implemented as part of this. Still, we need a lot of exploration there. But I found it very, very well done by Lambert that he basically put this on the meta level. There are no real, you know, drop-in solutions for the current status, but it's more a question of thinking and how to bring this to a practical stage. But maybe, Matthias, because you directly talked with Lambert afterwards, did I miss anything?
Mm. I think the most important thing is more or less a very subjective impression for me, because if you were looking into the faces of the Barcamp attendees while Lambert was giving his ignition talk, you could see that this is kind of a level of complexity that still is more or less a riddle to a lot of people. Because over the last couple of years, we have been talking a lot about infrastructure, and we have been talking a lot about repositories and metadata and linked metadata and all these kind of rather technical concepts that are graspable, though not easy to understand. But suddenly we talk about peer-to-peer networks, we talk about decentralization, we talk about technologies, certain technologies such as blockchain, that are even more complex and even more difficult to understand, because they have so many facets that kind of touch different aspects mathematically. It touches aspects of secrecy, it touches aspects of decentralization and how to, where it puts something, how and where, and so it becomes really difficult to understand because there's so much going on. And I think this is one thing that we will see quite a bit and for quite a bit of time in the upcoming future, that a lot of people struggle with understanding how this might work and how they can actually embrace it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially with associated with the question and what does it mean for my daily scientific routine. Eh?
Yeah.
So what will change? And I think, so you're right. This topic is really in the, really far in the future. So far, I would say, and it will somehow, the ideas will be really a radical change of the current system. Especially, for example, you mentioned Sünke Bartling. I think he also, they also had ideas about a completely new organizing of funding with such decentralized, based on blockchain technology system. So I think that's why many people still think, okay, sounds interesting, but so far I cannot judge how it will affect me.
Mm. And once again, I mean, the Barcamp is the ideal place to discuss this, right?
Yeah, right.
As I said, fair data and so on, done, right? This is more or less now taken care of, maybe a little bit too optimistically speaking, but this is tick, yeah? Next
would say research data management is somehow discussed. Fair data, I think we have to wait a bit. What is discussed on the high level policy part, and then see how we can deal with that.
But it's on the track, basically, right? Well, yeah. Here we have a topic that is really, really cutting edge, where most people, as Matthias said, have actually not always a clear concept in mind or don't understand this completely, and where we now have to see, okay, in which kind of niches or where can we actually place it and where can we make real use of this, or is it, you know, is it just a bubble, is it just a bullshit bingo word now, and also this has to be kept in mind, and this is why I found it very interesting, and this is exactly the place, a bar camp where these kind of topics can be discussed. And by the way, we had this session afterwards with Lambert and some other people, and there were also people from the publishing industry in there, because they wanted to understand this, how this could be affecting them, how they can make use of this. And from this perspective, it's again a perfect format for broad exchange of ideas and discussing these kind of things.
I think it was the session with Wolfgang Büchner. We'll definitely link it. And one last remark regarding this. I think what makes it even more complicated is that because the broader attention was brought to blockchain technology through the evolvement of something like Bitcoin. And I think this is probably something that helped a lot to get the idea out there and to make it more or less, make people more or less aware that something like this exists. But it will be quite an obstacle for us, because people will, when they hear blockchain, they will immediately start thinking about these financial aspects that technologies like Bitcoin and so on brought with them. And it will be really hard to convince them and to show them that there's actually a lot more behind this and how this works, and that this is not an investment issue per se, but it's more or less a data storage and data management, data distribution issue. And this will be quite a bit of work to be done over the next couple of years.
Right.
So yeah. We will see. We are looking forward to the blockchain sessions at the Barcamp next year.
Exactly. And another technological topic that is pretty close to my heart was clearly the one regarding Skolia, or basically anything related to Wikidata. So one of these technologies run by or developed by the Wikimedia Foundation, especially actually the one in Germany. So this is really a cool thing, and there's now prototype for this, for a real application in science there, so I can also heavily invite to listen to that one. And I guess this is again a good example how infrastructure can shape the scientific practice or the work there. Okay, I think we roughly covered the bar camp, and whoever feels he or she needs more information, there for each camp, for each session, there's a meta pad, there's a pad a notes or an etherpad where people could take notes with links and so on. And I guess this is a good starting point. We also have the individual episodes of those sessions with the host of that session. So whoever likes to have more information regarding this, I would like to refer to these now. And well, I think it won't be the last one, right?
Yeah. So we have to continue what is working good and well. So after the barcamp is before the barcamp. So there will be a barcamp next year, again in Berlin. It will be on March the 18th, and it will be again at Wikimedia. So show must go on, and we do not change the running system. And I think we have maybe minor changes what we learned from this year, but so I think the basic setting for Barcamp Open Science 2019 will be very similar to this year, but we expect many new faces and many new participants.
Yeah, and I guess we said in the beginning, but as I said, newbies are highly, highly welcome there, and it's very important to bring new ideas into the pool, right? Okay, yeah. Good. So, well, the barcamp was basically the first part. And after this, let's say the more high-level oriented open science conference took place. And again, this was rather a mixture of many different people. But maybe you can give us a rough understanding what was that precisely there.
Yeah, so the Open Science Conference is in contrast to the barcamp, the bigger event. So the barcamp is some sort of pre-event, and it's more high-level oriented. So it's a mixture of invited presentations and poster sessions and panel and so on. So a mixture between high-level and hands-on, I would say. Like last year, we also have been fully booked this year after 4 weeks, and we had 200 participants. And what we can observe is that we somehow, achieved it to establish the Open Science Conference as one important conference on the topic in Europe. So, the participants are very international. At the barcamp, we had, somehow international community there. But we have to say it's a focus on Europe. So mostly people from Europe are coming to this Open Science conference so far. Yes, and as I said before, it was again a good mixture between high level and hands on. So if I would summarize the central topics or key essentials that have been discussed, it would be said open science has reached the communities. So we had some talks about practical experiences in adopting open science or ideas on that. Then I think another key essential or lesson learned is that, of course, researchers need more support. This was addressed in many presentations, so there's still a gap to reach the broad amount of researchers. And I think another important topic in the context of research data management is, of course, everything what happened in the European Open Science Cloud and what is currently happening in the European Open Science Cloud pilot. And especially one topic, or interesting topic, what was addressed more on high level is this complete FAIR principles, FAIR data topic. So FAIR principles are currently adopted as a good way to implement future research infrastructures or to access research data. And now the question is how we can implement this. And there are different initiatives and ideas and stakeholders that are involved. And it was, again, the third important topic. But my experience was for this year that we had a good mixture between high level and hands on, and participants are interested in both, but they had some special interest in all these hands on contributions. For example, talks from Felix Schönbord and Emily Zena, who reported from their experiences in their specific community, but also the poster session that we had this year again. So that was my basic observation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also think you did a good job on the recent years, because this was said often in talks there that this conference is actually the open science conference in Europe. I guess you gained now a lot of momentum with this, and people really see that this is a important meeting of the community inside of Europe to exchange on these, let's say, high level, but also some hands-on aspects of open science. So in a way, congratulations.
thank you.
and you also, I mean, again, you managed to address a broad spectrum of topics there. I think we have a small quote now from Sarah Jones, especially addressing one of these topics that popped up also in many talks is this fair data practices. And she had some wishes that she would like to address to the community. So maybe we can put this in here now.
The background is that, I mean, we are on the verge of rule, or do you say ruling out? I think it's probably to roll out the fair data principles or fair principles to a more user and use case oriented world. So we probably see people start adopting this, especially when they refer to tenders rolled out in the research programs such as Horizon 2020 and the upcoming FP9. And Sarah Jones was looking into a number of studies trying to come up with some meta ideas of how well the FAIR principles and the FAIR data management has been understood and where the chances, the potential of it lies, but also where the flaws of it lies. And she flagged a couple of problems. And in the end, she wrapped up, and I think she summed it up quite reasonably to what the main important points is and what she would like to see in the future. And that's what she said here.
So as Jean-Claude said, I suspect there will be a formal policy in FP9. Like the open access pilot, this will probably transition to policy. What I personally would like to see is a greater emphasis on research data management, because I think FAIR is still framed very much in terms of the sharing. And I think the management of data matters to individual research projects, regardless of what happens long term with their outputs. And also the DMP at the moment, if you opt out of the pilot, you don't have to do a data management plan. And I think it's problematic to link the data management plan to open data, because the data management plan is about how you're managing and handling your data. It's not about the openness alone. So I personally would like to see a mandatory DMP, even if people opt out of the openness, because it's still important that they manage their data.
I think what this shows is that you need a lot of support if you want to publish your data openly and make it accessible and make it reusable. You probably need a lot of support from institutions, from people know how to deal with these things, especially when it comes to the official data management plans that you need to provide when getting research funding from the European Union. But she makes a very clear point that that research data management has to be a bit more than that. You can't just opt out if you don't want to publish your data. You still have to provide a data management plan for your research data, because it will be still relevant and important for all the following research to come. And she made a lot of points throughout her talk. I can really recommend it to look at her slides. And we probably take this topic up at one or the other occasion in the Open Science Radio. So we'll see about that.
Yeah. This was really a good quote, especially as you mentioned that even if you opt out from data publishing for certain reasons. So in the framework program, so they demand, or research data management plan is demanded, but you can opt out at any stage. So that is always possible. But even if you opt out, you have to manage your data so that it's not lost. That is, I think, a good point. And because she also talked about the fair data principles and FAIR principles. I think the FAIR data principles are also currently well adopted because they are not especially addressed openness as default. So in the community, they see a difference between open data and fair data. And open data as you know, it's all data must be accessible and all data must be published somehow, and fair data cannot be closed. They must not be open, but they have a basic characteristics like findable, accessible, interoperable, usable. And my thinking is that this fair data helps a lot that at adopting data management so far, because in the basic data management, the basis is a good data management. If you don't have good data management, you cannot think about open data. And so my hope is that they start with adopting these FAIR principles for doing good data management. And if your data is findable, accessible, interoperable, usable, it cannot also be easily open. So at the end is, if you have FAIR data plus open data applied, that could be really good data management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely, you need this foundation first before you can make this, before you can make stuff, data really open, right? Yeah. Okay. Another thing another talk that we picked was by Felix Schönbrot, who is a psychologist working at the University of Munich. And he addressed many different parts of, opening up science. Maybe you would like to address this?
Yeah, so I think in his talk, he addressed both. This one is his concrete experiences from his psychology domain, where they saw that we have a reproducibility problem and we have to change that. And they started to adopt open science practices to be more so that their research outcomes are more reproducible. And that's starting from with sticks and carrots. Yeah. So they created some incentive structures. For example, there was a journal that they put a badge, an open data badge, on publications that have this associated data with the publication. And they could prove that this open data badge increased the number of citations, I think. But also you need some sort of some policies, yeah, that so you are somehow more forced to be more open. And what was also interesting he mentioned is that his department, his psychology department in the LMU Munich, position for open practices is demanded in professorship positions. And on the other hand, what I really liked is that he reflected everything on a more general way. And, he said that generally open science should be, science in general. So, this would be the default way, the natural way to do science. And, I think he reflected on then on different perspectives, and I think Matthias, you prepared some interesting snippets for us that show his thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Before we come to that, what I like about Felix's talk is that he makes clear that we are actually inside two bubbles. One is a very small bubble compared to the other, being the community of those people involved in the open science movement and being probably the majority of the guests of the open science conference. And the other bubble is everybody else in the academia. And he made it very clear that those two bubbles deviate from one another in quite a drastic way. While we in the smaller open science bubble embrace all the opportunities and embrace all the potentials that open science brings, while actively working on how to deal and how to solve the problems that it might cause. Whereas in the outer bubble, in the bigger bubble that includes everybody else in the academia, open science is something that is on the verge, still on the verge of being hardly relevant. We see definitely some increasing over time, but it's still not a major issue. It's still not a major topic throughout the whole academic world. And he supported his arguments by looking at one, his own domain, being psychology, and two, his situation as being still considered as an early researcher, one of those who's already into the scientific system, but who has not yet earned all of the heavy duty merits that professors and all the important people, in air quotes, have inside the academia. And he made two really interesting points. One, he brought up a slide talking about how early researchers argument about their opinion on open science. And that one is really interesting because it gives you a lot of insight. And let me play this one. There we are.
And this means that especially early career researchers are really stuck. I often make workshops on open science, and sometimes we do an anonymous FAQ session. So the participants hand in anonymously questions that they have about open science. And it's good to do it anonymously because then you get the unfiltered feelings and sentiments of these researchers. And these are original quotes. For example, what would be a good balance between open science and having a career in academia? Being open, in my humble opinion, is a competitive disadvantage. Can you only afford open science when you are tenured? That's another one. Why should I share my hard-won data with my rivals that presumably compete with me for the next postdoc position? Or that one. My contract is limited to 2 years. 1.5 already have passed. Although it would be nice to publish the data, I have no time to do it. I rather have to churn out another publication. So at least in their feelings, there's a contradiction between doing good research and having a career in science. And this is a very unfortunate situation, especially for the early career researchers.
And he's so right about this. And the tragic point is what he said a couple of slides before. Actually, you find in between those early career researchers, you find a huge majority of those who would be willing to do open science, to work openly in their academic work. And that's just tragic that that there are no mechanisms in place yet that kind of give them freedom to seize the potential that various open science aspects actually hold. In the opposite, they are forced into disregarding a lot of the stuff that they could do openly due to various factors such as time limitations, budget limitations, but also like reputation limitations, in air quotes.
Yeah, I mean, luckily he also provides by himself also the one solution that is actually the mentioned job quotes that the job offers where they basically ask for this. But clearly this is an exception so far, and I completely agree that there is a lot of things that need to be done and to promote this kind of behavior.
Yeah. Luckily, he did not end on a bad note. He actually gave a couple of ideas what could be done in order to kind of provoke this cultural change, to spark it, and to how to achieve a system that kind of gives support and enables open science. And he did that based on, I think, a tweet storm, he said, he called it, by Brian Nosek, mm-hmm. That he read a couple of days before. And that was so fitting. And that's actually the next quote, which is roughly about 2 minutes, where he shortly lined out what he would see as five possible steps on the way to enable and embrace open science movement in the academic world. And this is also really interesting.
If we want to achieve a cultural change, we have to address these barriers. And there recently has been a nice tweet storm by Brian Nosek, who proposed a five-step scheme for achieving cultural change. And I really like the scheme. So the first step is implementation. We need a reliable infrastructure that makes it possible to do the behaviors. If there is no repository, I simply cannot share my data. At that stage, I will get the idealists, the enthusiasts. As soon as there's a technical possibility to do it, well, this small group of early adopters, they will do it. But we want to get a broader, we want to leave our bubble, we want to get a broader range of researchers, and the second step is called interfaces. Workflows that make it easy to do the behaviors. So it's not just possible, it should be also easy. With that step, we will get the supporters, which support the values in principle, but need the easy user-friendly tools to do the behavior. The third step would be norms. Communities define what is good scientific practice. So this relates to this barrier. Sharing data is not a common practice in my field. If we achieve to change the norms that it would be normal to share the data, we would get the substantial middle looking for guidance. Just they look, okay, what will the others do? Well, I do the same. Next step would be incentives. We could reward openness. With that step, we can get the pragmatics. They want to see, okay, I can do it, but I want to get something for it. That's the proper recognition for data sharing. And the final step would be policy, simply requiring openness. Well, the last step, this is targeted at it's called the resistant adherence to status quo. If you don't get them by norms or incentives, well, you get them by policy.
And what I find really intriguing about how he built that up, or how Brian built that up, is to make the connection to the typology of people in their attitude towards open science. Coming from enthusiasts over supporters up to the majority of people who probably wait for, okay, now it has been a rule, so I have to adhere to it. It makes a lot of sense to me, at least.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So also for me, this is the most recommended slide in his talk, because it really shows, for me, it's really also easy understandable, this approach, going from infrastructure to implementation interfaces to defining norms on that, how to use this from the community-based up to the high level that policymakers have to adopt this. And yes, I like this quote, when incentives are not enough, you need policies at
yeah.
the end.
Yeah, right.
If incentives do not work, you need at the end some policies so that you have some pressure to do this. This is really, really, I really like this slide.
All in all, his talk is really recommendable, because in the beginning, he's also referring to the Mattonian principles and compares it. How does the open science community actually adhere to those principles, and how does the academia in general behave to those? And you can really see contradictions there. It's really groundwork amazing. It's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another talk, also, let's say, more hands-on or more from a, let's say, young investigator, is from Emily Sina. Maybe let's discuss this quickly. Guido, what was her topic?
Yeah, so I think this talk from Emily Sinner was comparable to Felix's talk. She works in the medical domain, and she's working in context of so-called preclinical research. And it's somehow comparable, I think, but their progress in the community is not as far as in the psychology community. But they started with a problem of replication of research results because of missing data or undocumented data, whatever. So they also had duplicates. They have some studies that showed, okay, results are not reproducible. The second thing is that specifically for the domain, the typical behavior in research is that you publish positive results and negative results or neutral effects are not published. And this has the effect in their domain that, for example, the benefit of some treatment is somehow judged better than it actually is because negative results have not been published. So that is, they realize this as a problem. That is good. And they want to address that problem. And she showed with many tools that already exist how this problem of doing research data management, publish research data, and use openness to tackle this problem, that there are many tools out there you can use along this complex workflow that you can use as a workflow. And one example is also that you can use a so-called pre-registration for methodologies. So before you're conducting a study, you register your idea and what you want to do so that people can comment on that. This is also, I think, in the meantime, also quite well, they try to achieve this also in the psychology domain. So that is so I think it's a different example, different domain, but it shows compared to Felix's talk that the starting point was, okay, we have a reproducibility problem and we want to address it with open method. And I think they need a new, I think so they are not rather at the beginning in contrast to the psychology domain, but I think it's a good development that you can see that different domains started to adopt open science. They give them, they define some new norms of openness in the community. I think this is a good development.
What I really liked about this one, it's a tangible example, right? Let's say if people complain about this publication bias that maybe certain, or let's say that more positive results are much more often published than negative ones, one might think, so what? Yeah, okay, it's a dead end. But here you clearly see an impact on treatment of people with certain drugs. And this is something that I guess, you can communicate easily to people and see the importance of also publishing negative results. And this is an important part of open science also that, things that fail are also accessible, are published and are becoming part of common knowledge.
And this is a good example for, it's not about the money. Because the most actors that actually fail in reproducing the results is the medical industry or the pharma industry more. And she has a slide on there showing how much of the work that is being reproduced actually produces correct results or has inconsistencies. And the majority, like 65% or something, has severe inconsistencies. And there's a number of of pharma in companies that actually reproduce the results correctly, and even with the financial power that they have, they can't do it because they simply can't figure out the correct workflows, the correct data that is involved. And that's why it is about opening up instead of just putting more money on it.
Mm.
All right, and another interesting talk, maybe that is even, let's say, further on the meta level, was by Wolfram Horstmann. So what was he talking about, Guido?
Yeah, so I liked his talk because, so he was more reflecting on open science, and I think he addresses really interesting aspects of open science, which also refers to the problem how to explain and how to convince researchers to do open science. And one thing what I really liked is that he said, okay, we need 90 minutes to explain the complete complexity of open science. How do we want to convince researchers to do open science? It's really hard for them to understand everything. So this was a question for me. Do we need some sort of elevator pitch for open science? So how to convince in 2 minutes a scientist to be more open, maybe also in small portions. And another thing is what was interesting, because he connected this open science discussions, open science movement currently with the, what we learned, where he tries to learn from open access. He has also a slide on that. And one interesting point is, not so interesting, it's that it took 25 years before open access became popular on a wide scale. And what does it mean for open science? And he asked, okay, then open science will be popular on a wide scale then in 2035. So that really reflects our my impression that this is a really a slow development. And it really takes a lot of time to that really open science is adopted in a broader way. And the third thing, interesting question was about that he said, open access solves the problem of accessing scientific literature. And he asked, what is the problem that open science does solve? So that is an interesting point about thinking is, first of all, in my opinion, open access should not only solve the problem of accessing scientific literature, but also to correct some sort of broken publishing system. And the question now is, what does open science solve? And that also, and I think about it, that the open science also have the idea to correct the science system. It's a very evangelistic topic and not so on a pragmatic level. So, and this is an interesting question about, so can we define a concrete problem like accessing scientific literature, what open science does solve, or is it just the problem is that the science system is broken? That is a problem. So what is the problem that open science should solve?
Yeah, I guess this can be a longest discussion. Yeah, yeah. What parts can be actually done? But it's important, right? And also that this can be ideally be dense down or dense or communicate in a very dense form, and this will be very hard. I guess this is one of the major problems that he said, right? It's very hard to bring this topic into the heads of people without spending a lot of time, and I think we have to make this investment. And we are definitely doing this. Our podcasts are rather long, so it's definitely an issue, and it's important. Yeah. And I just hope that it's kind of a non-linear behavior, so that that it's hard in the beginning, but at some point you have kind of a switch, and let's say the first 20% is tough, and then the last 80 is easier because you have institutions behind all this movement, and that it's then easier to roll this out to a broader population of the scientific community. But let's see. Definitely something to keep in mind. Yeah, I guess we are now kind of at the end of this. We can still heavily invite you to listen at the episodes that we recorded regarding this. We also, we have not mentioned this so far, have recordings of some parts of the poster session. So Matthias and me, we went through the poster session and talked to the presenters there. There are also some very interesting projects presented. So if you have not done that, have a look at those. They are clearly a little bit shorter, but they give a good overview about these kind of topics. Similar thing here as for the Open Science Barcamp. This won't be the last Open Science conference, luckily. Guido.
Yes, yes, of course. So, okay, in this episode, we selected three talks, but we had more interesting talks and all slides are published. And we also had 19 poster presentations, some with a lightning talk. So all material is linked in the program. So I really invite everybody to check the conference program and to see what other talks have been there, and check the slides, and also check the plenty Open Science Radio episodes for the poster session to see what was more at the Open Science conference that we could address here now. So yes, you're right. We continue the Barcamp, and of course we continue the Open Science conference as well. So Barcamp will be on March 18th. So consequently, the Open Science conference will be 2 days after the Barcamp. So that will be March the 19th and the 20th, 2019. But we haven't discussed so far what main topic could be next year. But I think, and I hope that we can agree that we have again more hands-on sessions, because they are really wanted by the community, and we have to scale up a bit. So I think next year we will go up to 200 participants. And again, we will have a call for product presentations to again provide some sort of poster session, or if we extend it in a way, we don't know. But so this will be the basic setting. So save the date for next year, and for some of you, wait for the upcoming call.
I think it's a natural progression that we will see even more hands-on next year, because if you look at the talks, especially from Jean-Claude Bogelmann, who gave the European perspective on the whole issue on the background of the of the European Open Science Cloud, of the publishing platform, and all these kind of activities. All these activities start this year, will launch this year, so we will see a lot more practical experience next year with these activities that will be launched this year. So I think it's automatically more practice oriented.
All right. Yeah. I think this was a nice overview. As said, we could not cover everything, but it was really, again, a pleasure having Guido here around. And I think that this time we would start, end with a small funny quote from one of the drivers of this conference, or one of the, let's say, usual suspects who is always there and to push the borders, Jean-Claude Bogelmann. And I think with this we say goodbye to Guido. Thanks, Matthias, and bye, guys.
Okay,
Guido, last words.
Yeah, last words. So yeah, also thank you from my side. It was also for me a pleasure to work with you, and I hope that Open Science Radio is on board next year.
We will be.
Oh, definitely. Great. So now Bogelmann.
Right. The floor is yours, Jean-Claude.
September, the high level expert group, all our groups are high level, by the way. and we never created a low level expert group. That would actually be fun. So